This is CliffCentral.com.
Yeah, Sheryl Crow. All right, Richard says, I just saw an interview on ANN7 of Pastor Mboro. Wow, that interviewer just asked one question through the whole interview. What a useless journalist. ANN7 are terrible. They're just pathetic. I gave up on that news channel. P.S. I love your show, guys. You're doing a great job. Love the diversity of your group. Mabali being the sensible one. Sia the exuberant one. Ben the head comments just at the right time. Amanda's the party capital of South Africa. And Gareth, you sometimes are a bully, like the way Mabali stood up to you to hold her ground. Don't know what that's all about. Does that happen, Mab?
Are you a bully?
Am I?
Yeah, you have your bulldozing moments.
All in the name of love, all the way from Nelspruit, the place of the rising sun. Peace and love from Richard. All right.
I'm always interested to hear how listeners describe each of us. So, okay, today we're exuberant.
You're exuberant.
I'm exuberant.
Is that not true for you? You're the most exuberant person. I go with that.
I'm so subtle and just reserved.
Hell no.
Yeah, okay, sure. Heaving.
Reserved and quiet. Are you kidding
just
me?
Keep to
you
myself.
Think you're reserved and quiet?
In my head, I like to think
no,
that.
You're not. All right.
I didn't try that for a while.
Sizwe Mpofu Walsh. What a guy. You've done all of this. You're 28. I found out that you're married. This is an amazing human being, this guy. What are you, insane to be married at your age of 28 or something, right? What's that all about?
Well, all my friends expected me to be the last person to get married when it happened, but...
How did that happen? Who's this wife of yours?
Well, she's the most incredible woman in the world.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, when you meet that person...
You just knew?
I mean, what can you do but, you know, put a ring on it?
So how long have you been married?
Nearly 5 years now.
Wow, Caesar. So you were 23.
I was 23, that's right.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing.
5 years going strong.
So look, you are you're a very accomplished guy. You've done a lot of stuff in your 28 years, and it seems like you've got big plans for the future too. So we could talk about some of those later on. Last time I saw you, where was it? I'm trying to think, because I've known you for a long time now. It must be about 8 years or so.
Yeah.
I've known you longer than your wife. but obviously we've got a connection through your dad too.
Yeah, that's true. I think last time I saw you was actually in a courtroom.
It was my case where your dad was representing me.
That's right.
Oh, were you there as well?
Mm. Yeah.
He doesn't miss out on some interesting stuff.
Okay. Oh yeah.
He saw a chance to watch first of all his dad in action, and he was on fire that day.
Oh, he was.
But also it was an interesting sort of free speech issue.
It was.
And I mean, you've been involved in your own free speech issues over the years.
Oh,
we'll
yes.
talk about those too. But having a dad like Dali Mpofu, who's first of all a very well-known, very public figure, who is a bit of a lightning rod for opinion as well. Is it tough growing up with a dad like that? Because you kind of want to be your own man, but you are in this enormous shadow.
Mm.
Do you think it casts a shadow that keeps you in the dark, or do you think it gives you a little bit of protectio in situations where most people would be afraid to venture an opinion, and you think, hell, I don't have to worry.
Mm.
My dad's never sort of been the quiet guy in the class. I don't have to either. How did it affect you?
It's a bit paradoxical. Sometimes it opens doors that wouldn't otherwise be opened, and sometimes it creates premeditated views of what you want to say or what you're thinking, and so you're often judged before you even open your mouth. Sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse. It's funny, like funny example of the positive stuff. People think like people often tread carefully because they think like I can just sue them for anything
because
like,
your dad's
my
an
dad's
advocate,
a good lawyer,
yeah,
and I'm
right.
like that's not really how the law works. But I think it gives me these like protections when people, you know. But on the other hand. If I have an opinion about something, people think like my dad has like surreptitiously sent me out into the world to like plant this opinion in the world.
And of course, you couldn't be your own person, so you must have derived all those opinions from him.
Right. Another positive part of it is just that, you know, he grew up in rural areas of the Eastern Cape. He was in solitary confinement, detained for the first time at 17. So like being brave about political issues has never been a problem because that's been the example from both my mom and my dad. Mm-hmm. A negative part of it is people think I sprung from the loins of my dad, when my mom is just as important an activist and just as important an influence on the way that I think.
Do you think that's a kind of sexism?
Oh, absolutely.
You know, because a man, yeah, he must have been in the armed struggle. He must have been far more involved. Whereas your mom, she probably made cupcakes and sold them for money.
Exactly. Well, funny story. One of the only times my dad's lost a political election was to my mom when she was the branch chairpersons of the ANC in Gauteng when it was unbanned. So she often reminds him of that.
How did they meet?
They met at WITS. It's actually quite a scandalous story. So my mom was my dad's warden at residence. She's 14 years my dad's senior.
Wow.
So my dad was a student.
It's a cougar.
I like it.
He was a Ben 10.
My mom moves. And so there was apparently this dance at the residence, and my dad went up to my mom and asked her if she would dance as the warden, and they danced, and here I am.
Your dad, I don't want to talk about your dad all the way through this because I got plenty to talk to you about.
For sure.
Your dad is just, he's also a rebel.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, if you tell him he can't, he's going to go the opposite direction, right?
For sure.
He does not care about rules.
Yeah.
He doesn't care about race rules.
Yeah.
He doesn't care about age rules. He doesn't care about philosophy rules. Mm. He's building his own reality, and he's one of the people who's done it in spite of everybody telling him he couldn't. Yeah. And huge, like, there was a lot of stress and pain in his upbringing.
Mm, absolutely. Like, I don't mind talking about him. I used to be like, oh, no, let's not talk about Matt. But I actually think this is a good opportunity to also share his story because a lot of people see him in the public eye, but they don't know where he came from. They don't know what he did. Like, to get to where he is, he had to get one scholarship in the Eastern Cape that was reserved for one black student.
Yeah.
And he was his matric class's maths teacher, you know. So, like, people don't know the journeys that a lot of black South Africans who are in prominent positions now had to go through to get to where they are.
Do you two sit and talk often about these things?
We do. We've had really interesting discussions, especially as I've matured and started having my own political ideas. We talk about the political situation in the country very often.
Do you argue?
We do. We have differences of opinion, but ironically, we agree on the main things. He's helped me with, like, the book that I wrote. I interviewed him about Marikana, for example. So,
well, let's talk about that because it's the last thing that I want to bring your dad in on, because you've also got very strong opinions about that. But yesterday was the anniversary. It's 5 years now since Marikana. And this is probably one of the ugliest chapters in South Africa's post-democratic history.
Absolutely.
It's something that I think most of us feel, well, there are a tiny minority of people who must feel that this was justified in some way, shape, or form. I think we know our enemy when we see them. What are your thoughts on this 5 years later? There are people who are saying that there's no justice that's been done, despite every attempt to, government pretending that it gives a damn.
Yeah, absolutely.
What do you think?
Look, I think Marikana was a turning point for our family. It was the point at which all of us, my mom, my dad, me, my siblings, realized that the political situation had reached the point of no return and that there was no changing the ANC for the better from within. Obviously, my dad then became involved in the case, and watching that up close and all the stuff that so many people don't know about and how the state tried to paint the lawyers as if they were enriching themselves.
Yeah, there's been some criticism of
that. Yeah, when actually, if you really look at it, they dug into their own pockets. They lost money to make sure that they, you know, represent it. Anyway, so there was that part, but then there was also just Marikana itself. And it's something that I write about in this new book, Democracy and Delusion. And there are a number of myths that still pervade around Marikana. For example, this idea that, you know, we're slowly moving towards justice. It's going to take a while, but, you know, there will be compensation in the end and, you know, people will be brought to book. No. 5 years later,
Not
one arrest. No one's been prosecuted. There's been no compensation. There's been no reparation.
All we've been doing is paying Ria Piecha's salary.
Absolutely. Ad infinitum. And I don't know when this is going to end. All the political people who were involved in it, the senior politicians, not only were they not punished, they actually rose through the ranks of the ANC and got rewarded. Mm. So, and then, of course, there's the myth that the police acted in self-defense. So I go through these lingering myths that still surround Marikana. And the sad truth of the matter is we're probably further away from justice now than we were when it happened, because the state has dug its heels in and they're just pretending as if they care, but then they have no intention of doing anything whatsoever.
you were very involved in a huge international uproar about Oxford and Cecil John Rhodes.
Yeah.
And you had some very strong opinions of that, which I as a person who appreciates free speech, and particularly when it comes from people who are running against the tide, swimming against the tide, I found myself agreeing and disagreeing with you a lot on that.
Sure.
What was the event? First of all, tell Mabali and Sia and everybody else what the story was there, because you were at Oxford studying at the time.
Yeah.
And you started this campaign, along with some other people, obviously, and it was very unpopular among a huge group of the students, and then quite popular among others, even people who weren't at the university. What actually happened?
Yeah, absolutely. So we started a conversation. We saw what was happening in South Africa, and we thought, should, you know, figures like Cecil John Rhodes, still enjoy being publicly represented in this deificatory way that they're being represented? Shouldn't we recontextualize the way that they're represented? And if they should be recontextualized in South Africa, why do they get a free pass at home? I mean, if you do something wrong and you come home, it doesn't mean like you haven't done something wrong just because you're at home. So we wanted to take that debate right into the heart of empire, as it were. Rhodes was an Oxford student, and we thought we would actually challenge him right where he was. That's how we could contribute to it, and because we were right there at the time. Now, what I learned in that process was just how global power works, right? Because in South Africa, you know, I'd seen certain things.
Oh, he's starting to sound like a conspiracy theorist.
Oh, man. Look, when you go to Oxford, you actually see things where you're like, wow, so this actually happens.
Mm-hmm.
But just the way that the British establishment came together to firstly paint us as like irrational people who were just like hooligans and ISIS, basically.
Yeah.
And they did that quite successfully. And then just to see how like heads of state from nowhere just started entering this debate. Like the former like Prime Minister of Australia just like piped up like, what are these students in Oxford doing? And it was like, how did you even find out about this? You know? So it was really interesting to watch how that happened. We started winning the debate in Oxford when people actually heard our arguments, and we won the debate at the Oxford Union, which is the main debating chamber. And then all of a sudden donors, when we started winning people over and it looked like we might actually get the statue replaced and put in a museum, donors actually were like, we're going to pull out our money if you do anything to the Rhodes statue. And that was the end of the debate.
Because money talks.
Right, right. And like you say about free speech, I mean, sometimes I think free speech can be used as a way of shielding privilege. But the real benefit of free speech is when people are protesting against power. Like in South Africa, I think that's one of the final things we have.
There is a destructiveness to the left when it comes to kind of trying to rewrite history and judging historical situations by current contexts. And you talk about recontextualizing the past. I mean, surely you are at least sensitive to the idea that Cecil John Rhodes in his time was considered a progressive, and as awful as a human being as he might be by today's lenses, this man you can't judge by today's means and ways, because women didn't even have the vote at that time, let alone black people. There was this bizarre hegemony of the British Empire, which extended as far as India and Australia and New Zealand and Canada. And it was a different universe in so many ways. And to look at it in these terms does make it very difficult for people who have an appreciation for history, or at least an understanding of the context of human stories through the course of the last couple. And we must add to those stories with the stories of those who've been underrepresented. But it seems to me almost as if a lot of people want to put you guys in the box of being just destructive. Postmodernist, let's tear it all down. And maybe in the ashes of what's left of civilization, we can start rebuilding. Is that your position?
Yeah, well, look, I wouldn't call it left or right, because I think sometimes as soon as you say, you know,
it boxes you.
Mm. Let's just talk about the issues themselves. The notion that recontextualizing a statue would be an erasure of history was the main counter argument, but I think there's really nothing to it. I mean, firstly, putting a statue up in a glorificatory way is also a way of obfuscating history. I mean, if you really wanted to tell the actual story of what happened in Southern Africa, you wouldn't just put a statue of Cecil Rhodes on the top of a building above the Queen to show that he's like, he asked for the statue to be put above the Queen because he said he was greater than like even the Queen and God and all that. You might be happy that he thought he was greater than God, but
I don't have an opinion on that.
Yeah. but I must tell you the story of when I met Richard Dawkins at Oxford.
Uh-huh.
But that's putting Cecil Rhodes in a museum is actually a way of bringing the actual history to the places where you go to find out about history.
Right.
So it's not an erasure of history to recontextualize a statue. If anything, having a deificatory statue that erases the 60,000 people that the British South Africa Company slaughtered, that's a way of erasing history because you don't know what Cecil Rhodes did. You just think he's this great person. But in actual fact, the history is much deeper and much more complex. So I would argue that recontextualizing statues of people who were central to the British Empire is actually a way of bringing history to the fore and bringing the truth to the fore, as opposed to these mythological fairy tales that make people who like the British Empire sleep better at night.
All right, so it's about where you put it and how you look at it in a historical context. But then the comparisons that were made, and I don't agree with these, by the way, between what you were trying to do and what ISIS does when it goes in and bombs the Buddhas of Bamiyan or knocks down ancient monuments to religions that they no longer agree with.
Yeah.
That must have been particularly egregious to you.
That really, I mean, that was just a scare tactic. I mean, nobody was talking about blowing anything up. You know, we were talking about recontextualizing a statue. And, you know, ISIS obviously scares people because of the fact that they were, like, killing innocent people. And then people go, oh, ISIS, statues, these guys are scary. No, I mean,
doesn't it feel like deja vu when you see what's going on in Charlottesville? And it all started over a statue.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
These things are very evocative.
They are, and that was the strategic idea, right? You know how much people invest their identities in these statues. So when you attack them and you see people defending them, you're like, what's the big deal about the statue? Why do you love it so much? What does it say to you, and why do you think it's important? And that, and we knew that when we attacked that, we'd be attacking the fundamentals of British identity in a way, and that's probably why the response was so vitriolic. But I think that's why it sparked such an interesting debate. Probably the most interesting debate that Oxford as a community has had in the last decade.
Tell me about when you met Dawkins.
So I'm he goes past you a lot in Oxford
because
it's quite a small.
Sure.
but the most memorable time is my friend invites me to high table at New College where Dawkins is a fellow, and so I'm just sitting down having supper whatever, and then like I look around and Dawkins comes to sit next to us and our group, and he's just like, hello, how are you? Fine. And he's the most like, you expect him to be this like
anti-Christ.
Yeah, and he's just like the most polite, hello, how are you? Very nice. And he'll talk to you about anything.
Yeah.
And you're just like, you have to pinch yourself because you're like, I'm sitting at a high table in Oxford next to Richard Dawkins right now. And like,
how do you respond to those people who say, oh, well, you know, Cizwe, you've got all these high-minded ideals about how you recontextualize the glorification of British history, but you attend Oxford. Aren't you a hypocrite? How do you respond to those people?
Sure. This hypocritical argument is, it's a bit unfair because like, where else would you like me to go? Unfortunately, like African institutions were destroyed by colonialism. It's going to take a long time to rebuild them.
And by the ANC, most
Well, that too.
More on that later, yeah.
But the point is that these institutions need to be transformed. Like, the idea that alumni who go to St. John's, for example, shouldn't speak out is basically an argument for separate development. Either you go there and you keep quiet, or you don't go there.
Gladwell podcast about this?
No.
It's fascinating. I'll let you hear it. He looks into a situation that they had at Yale, which was very, very similar, where there was a discussion around a certain painting or statue or something. Woodrow Wilson in this case.
Interesting.
And how the protesting students and then later the alumni came to a loggerhead on this and how it was resolved. And he actually suggested an interesting way of taking the situation up, which I thought I hadn't thought of at the time.
Yeah.
But he said also, when it's emotive and when there's anger from either side, whether it's because you're precious about your identity and history, or whether it's because you're precious about not being represented or by having a racist or a, you know, Woodrow Wilson didn't like black people.
Oh, yeah.
This is the guy who brought America into the First World War.
Hmm.
But in that time, he was considered a progressive. This was a guy who, for the first time, broke the idea of isolationism for America. And he was considered by the whole world to have been very insightful in building the League of Nations and entering World War I on the side of the Allies. Otherwise, God knows, we might have all been speaking German now. But all of this has to be looked at in a much wider context. And what Gladwell says is that sometimes you have to take the emotion out of these things, because that's the only way to make sensible choices and sensible decisions. Is it hard, because you're more of a, I think, a left brain person, is it hard for you to sometimes empathize with a bad opinion just because it's fueled by a good energy?
Probably. Probably as it is for most people, I would think. But I do also think that sometimes we say emotion as if that doesn't, you know, impart important content. You know, I think the fact that people are emotional about an issue or angry about an issue may in fact tell us that it was just a, like, I would hope people would be angry about, you know, many deaths and huge
sure.
injustice.
Absolutely.
So I think the fact that a lot of people are angry, for example, about colonialism or racism is indicative just rationally as well. My proposal is that we take the Rhodes statue from Oxford and we bring it to Cliff Central. What do you think?
I don't want to put it up here. I don't have any dog.
I don't know.
See, there we go.
But
we decline your proposal. Thank you, though. Thanks.
We've had a caucus and we've decided
very
it's on.
But guy, history, people.
Look, I'm the kind of guy who I have the rather extreme view that even Nazi memorabilia should be kept somewhere.
Okay.
Because I think that otherwise we have the tendency to forget and history repeats itself and you have people saying that Trump is Hitler, which as awful as Trump is, it's a terrible comparison to make, because what it does is it dilutes the nastiness of Hitler rather than improve the nastiness of Trump, which we know so many people in America are trying to do. So it's a bad argument. But I wouldn't want a statue like that here, because to me, this is not, he's not my dog and I'm not in that fight.
Sure.
And I think a lot of people also feel that way. Unfortunately, you know, you and I are also in the minority because we care about history.
Right.
Most people really don't.
I mean, a lot
of people are more interested in what's going to happen in Game of Thrones this week than in the past of this country and how fractious and difficult and how complex and how incredibly interesting it is. Okay, opinions. Because I know you've got a good brain, so I always like when people like you are in here to not talk so much biography, because people can look that up.
Yeah, sure.
And talk more about how you feel about the world and what you think of the world. What do you think of identity politics?
I don't like the term, because all politics is identity politics in many ways. Politics is about what people care about, how they're brought up, and the way that what you care about is formed is through the way that you're brought up. So I think it's often used as a kind of smear tactic for people who are bringing up important issues about, say, race or gender or sexual orientation. But what I will also say is that I think there is a limit to the usefulness of hyper-reflexive politics. You know, this notion that your position is all that matters and nobody can say anything unless they're in a certain position.
Yeah.
I tend to agree.
That's that hierarchy of victimhood stuff.
Right. And that can become very dangerous, both just rationally but also strategically, because I think a lot of these...
But primarily because it excludes the individual and it limits their ability to voice an opinion based on where they are and who they are.
Right.
Which is, of course, the opposite of equality.
Right. So, look, I would say that it's really important what your position is, but I just wouldn't go to the extreme of saying it's the only thing that matters and only certain people can ever speak about certain issues. And I think there's sometimes a danger with what I think people call identity politics, that certain voices are excluded and people just are literally just bullied. You know, and they're bullied in the language of progressive radical politics, but it's just not being a good person. You know what I mean?
And so are you sometimes co-opted into groups that you don't feel a part of because people think they know you look just like Malcolm X right now. It's either the glasses or something. You were just looking at me now with a serious expression on your face. I wish I'd taken a picture of that.
I can see that.
Right, Mubs?
Yeah, I see.
I'll take it.
I mean it as a compliment. I'm not trying to be horrible.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so when you get co-opted into a group that you're not a part of, does that infuriate you? Because to me, that's one of the worst things you can do to me, is when you assume I have a point of view because I'm a certain age, certain race, certain gender, perhaps from a certain kind of background.
Mm.
Does that drive you crazy too? Because you are difficult to put in a box.
Mm.
You don't have just one racial background. You don't have just one educational background. You don't have a single-minded point of view politically. Does it drive you crazy?
It does. It goes back to that thing we were saying at the beginning about people's preconceptions. Sometimes it happens with my father, but sometimes it happens from the perspective of my identity, and people assume that I'll take certain positions because they think certain things about me. And I think that happens with all of us. What I did learn at Oxford with the Rhodes Must Fall thing was that there was a lot of pressure to be the most radical person. And there's a sense in those spaces where the most radical person wins the day, no matter what they say. So there's this kind of race to the bottom of being radical.
Mm-hmm.
But I also realized that I need to be honest enough to realize that I actually have a lot of privilege too. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm a man. I'm gendered as a man, for example. Mm-hmm. I went to St. John's.
Mm-hmm.
I'm black too. So there is a lot of stuff about me that falls in the category of oppression.
Right.
But I also needed to realize that, like, I'm not necessarily the best spokesperson for certain things, and I need to understand and own the fact that I am privileged to some extent. And that took a while because, like, my father's story is so difficult, and, you know, I still have family living in the rural areas of the Eastern Cape, despite the fact that everyone thinks we're, like, these extremely rich people, which is, you know, just not the case. So you want to tell the world, like, you don't understand how hard it is, but then you realize that it's actually harder for other people too, mm-hmm. and you have a lot of privilege that you need to be honest enough to own.
That thing that you were just saying about the race to the bottom of being the most radical, this is a temptation. I remember a story someone told me about Socrates, how when people started applauding too wildly at one of his lectures, he would just leave because he didn't want to be a lightning rod for other people's feelings and opinions and moods and emotions.
Mm.
And I think maybe where Fees Must Fall lost its way is that those people in it who were enamored of that kind of public acclamation, that those people started to believe their own publicity, and it got derailed a little bit. It was such a powerful movement for a while. All of us were behind it. And then somehow it just became this, like, ragtag, destructive, and not particularly cohesive unit where everything was suddenly an issue that they tried to bring under the one umbrella, and it lost its purpose.
Look, I mean, I'm a big supporter of what the students have done, and I think there are a lot of other reasons why the movement kind of metastasized and mutated, partly because of the way that the state and the universities handled it and the violence that was inflicted on the students. But I do think that, you know, there were some elements which the media certainly accentuated, which mm-hmm. I think were much bigger than the actual.
And the media loves to make a big story out of nothing.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And again, you know, students were.
We sound like Donald Trump, but it's true.
I know, fake news.
Fake news, the media.
Right. Yeah, but I agree, and I think, like, where in the small instances where mistakes were made, that was it. And look, we had a really interesting debate in South Africa about identity,
yeah.
about privilege, about who gets to speak about what at what point in history, and. What I realized in Oxford was we're really at the forefront of that global debate. Like, the debates we're having about race in South Africa, about gender in South Africa, are, like, light years ahead of mm-hmm. even the debates that are happening in Oxford. Like, at that time of Fees Must Fall and Rhodes Must Fall, everyone was looking to South Africa to see what was happening. What were people saying? We were actually at the forefront of thought.
It's
leadership.
Gritty here. Like, there it's a bit rarefied,
yeah.
And septic and antiseptic rather, and distant, right?
Definitely.
Like, here we're dealing with this stuff because it actually affects people's lives.
Yeah. The funny story is that, like, my first week of Oxford, I turned on the TV to watch the House of Lords, and they were having this very big, serious debate about, like, whether badgers should be kept in like people's estates or something. And there was this, like,
everything
huge
in context.
Yeah, right. Like, there was this, and people taking sides, and the media was all, and I was like, wow, like, back in. The beautiful thing about being in South Africa right now is everything is up for grabs. Our society is still finding its way. We can determine which way it goes. We can change it. All the big debates are still live. And what's kind of stultifying about Britain is so many of the major debates are already settled, and they're just debating around the margins right now. And it's a difficult place to be because we all have, like, PTSD in South Africa, I think, just
yeah,
from, like, last week's
right.
news cycle. But it's also a really exciting and historic place to be.
All right. You reference Piketty. quite a lot in your book, and when it comes to economic policy, and obviously his writings have had quite a lot of influence, not only on you in this case, but on a lot of people who believe that wealth inequality or income inequality is a real thing and that it's getting worse. Do you believe that? I mean, are you of the opinion that he is one of the few people who's speaking the truth about economic situations in particularly the West?
What he says about South Africa, I think, is true. And I think
what in particular?
What he says about the fact that inequality has got worse since 1994.
Now, he says there are two ways to address that, and this is what I want to get into with you, because there are a couple of people who've also read Piketty who think that there might be merit in these discussions. Mm-hmm. The first thing he says is that if you have enough growth, inequality isn't an issue. And this is a problem that we have to grapple with now, because we must fall into position two, which I'll get to in a second, because we don't have enough growth. So inequality becomes a much bigger issue, and it becomes wider, that gap between rich and poor. So the second outcome that he proposes in a situation where there's inequality and growth is not a factor, and we have tiny, if at all, any growth in this country right now in our economy.
Yeah.
So people are suffering and they'll suffer more. He says then government intervention is required. Now, would you want this government intervening?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so let's take those two things. I mean, the first thing is I think inequality is bad, but I think it's the problem with inequality is you want everyone to be above a certain threshold. Mm. I don't have a problem with certain people being wealthy or earning more than other people, but the problem in South Africa is that inequality is so wide that a tremendous – in the book, I show that 53%, according to Stats SA, of South Africans, which is crazy, are in poverty. So when so many people are below a certain threshold and so few people have a lot, that's the kind of inequality that I think is a problem. And the fact that that's been exacerbated in the last 23 years, I think is really scandalous.
Well, it's the ugliest grade of the ANC's report card, really.
It is, and
because that's the very people who they were meant to have helped first.
Yeah, yeah, it is, and the crazy thing that Piketty shows is that in South Africa, wealth and income inequality are worse than they've been. The only time they were like this was in the late colonial era. That's how
the 1800s.
Yeah. Like he's got a graph of how he measures inequality, and the last time we were in this position was the late colonial era. It's literally that bad, and I don't think people understand how
so how do we fix that? Because clearly growth is not going to happen anytime soon, because we have got several reasons why the economy has been pulverized.
Yeah.
and it's just static.
Sure.
So that's not an option, and unless we can figure out a way to make it grow very quickly, which I don't think these politicians we currently have in power are able to do, then does it require government intervention in another way? And would we trust this government to intervene correctly? Or would we see a reflex action on their part in order to ensure their own survival?
Yeah. Well, I know one way we could do it very easily. I offer lots of different new solutions in this book, but it relates to land reform. Okay. So a lot of people, you know, talk about land reform and it's become this hot button issue, but there's actually a very
The ANC has also stolen from the EFF as an issue.
Right, and then done nothing about, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, they've had this on their agenda supposedly from the beginning, but nothing's ever happened.
I trace the failures, which are monumental.
All right, but let's leave them out of it. Your solution.
Right, right. So the thing about land reform, let's leave commercial agriculture aside for the moment, right? It's important. We can come back to that, but that's only one aspect of land reform. Mm. Another aspect of land reform that nobody talks about is this thing called tenure reform. So in the former homelands,
I know where you're going.
Right. Basically, Cecil Rhodes and his ilk created the system where people could reside on land, but they don't own the land that they live on. So they have permit rights, but they don't have ownership rights.
That's even the case with Nkandla.
Oh, okay. Well, there we go.
So even the president's house is tribal land.
Right. Okay, so we can exclude that from my solution. But
well, it would, as Julius said a while ago, make a good school.
It would. I'm telling you.
All right.
So, with the stroke of a pen, and the ANC promised to do this in 1997, you say to 20 million South Africans who currently live in the former homelands, you now have access to this land, it's yours. You live on it already.
They can borrow against that, start their own businesses. They can sell it if they want to.
Absolutely. Now 20 million people suddenly have land. You've changed. You've done the biggest action to redistribute wealth in the history of South Africa.
Why are they not doing this?
I do not know. My hunch is that they've taken the short-term political decision that if they can, the new policy they have is we're going to give this to traditional leaders. So,
which is why the president's spending so much time with those traditional leaders and reinforcing the idea that these are the people who make the decisions.
Right, right. And look, I don't have any problem with traditional leaders. They're recognized in the Constitution. They can administer disputes within the territory. They can do what the Constitution empowers them to do, right? Yeah. But they don't get to own the land that belongs to the people. Transfer the land to the people, give the people the power, and you have redistributed wealth like no administration has ever done in South Africa. Now 20 million people have land. Now economic inequality has been radically reversed, and it can be done very quickly.
Such a simple solution. And if you – and please, I hate it when people say, you know, you're young, so you shouldn't be making a huge difference. But, I mean, like this is in your book, and there are people – 8 times your age who haven't bothered to implement it, and they have the levers of power right in front of them. Goddamn book.
That, like, I can't tell. There are literally times when I cried when I was writing this book because I was like, the solutions are right in front of us.
Everybody's going to say this to you. They've already said it to you. Are you interested in a political career?
Definitely. Whether that's a conventional political career, I don't know yet.
Someone once came up to me and said, do you want to be someone who is after power, or do you want to be someone who's after influence? It was a bit of an aha moment for me. Because I always also thought when I was growing up, oh, politics is something that I might want. Because you can make the biggest difference, right?
Yeah.
As Thabo Mbeki used to say, the art of the possible. Well, not just him, but a lot of people.
Sure.
If you want power, you have to enter the machinery of political parties, of the legislature, maybe the executive, the judiciary, if you need to. If you want influence, maybe there are more powerful ways that you can make things happen from the outside. Which appeals to you most?
Right now, I've gone for the latter. And I've realized that young people often just tune out when they know that someone's connected to some political party or some agenda. And I just want to reach them directly. And that's also why, together with this book, there's also a companion album. So there's a hip-hop album of 10 songs which relate to the 10 chapters in the book. And I want to reach young people where they are. And, okay, yeah, by the way, I must drop a verse at the end of
this interview. No, we want you. Yeah, no, we want this.
So what I want to do is really change the conversation, conscientize young people about the way that I think they're getting a raw deal and have been getting a raw deal. And where that goes, I'm not sure. I'm always going to be involved in political debate, public debate, but I'm still resolving this problem of conventional politics and the changes you can make, but then subscribing to a political home and then having people tune out to what you want to say.
Don't you think that the party as an idea is something that's dying out a little bit? Just like the state is really something that should die out eventually.
In many ways, yeah. I mean,
you'd be the perfect first ever real independent candidate. I mean, I'd be impressed with the kinds of argument you'd have with other people.
Sure. Yeah, I think it would be cool in South Africa if we could directly elect a president. I think the last decade has shown us how that might benefit us. but yeah, like, so someone was at a conference where Mark Zuckerberg spoke. And was telling
he's
us
he's got political ambitions.
He was telling us this, and this person who went to the conference was telling this group of us this in Oxford. And someone asked him, "Look, do you want to be the president of the United States?" And his response was, "By the time I'm done, I won't need to."
Now you see, that frightens me a little bit because Zuckerberg is one of those kids who was bullied at school. He'll take it all out on us,
right?
Later on.
So yeah, you're right.
He'll be a horrible boss. Yeah. Horrible boss.
Yeah, so but you're right, like power is changing.
Okay, so how do you see the state? I mean, we could get into this. I could talk to you for hours. How do you see the state developing or self-destructing in the next 5 to 10 years? Because it's already happening. You see people are less and less engaged in – and these nations who keep talking to each other through diplomatic channels or whatever, and then WikiLeaks proves that they're actually just bullshitters who are trying to keep the rest of us under thumb – How do you feel about the state and where it's going?
What I think is going to happen is that, remember, the state is so powerful in so many places that I think what you're going to get is you're going to get these super states that become even more powerful. And then you're going to get states that aren't as powerful as them becoming less and less relevant. So you're going to get this inequality in the state system where, like, the United States has access to everything and they have access to the biggest servers and everything that a huge multinational company has. But then you're going to get states that are so powerless that, like, a small United States company could change the way that, like, the entire population. There's this dude, Jaron Lanier. He's one of the people who claims, a lot of people claim to have, like, been part of the founding of the internet and whatever. But his idea is that if you find the biggest server, that's where the most power resides. So the people with the biggest servers have the most power in the world. The banks, big tech companies, and the thing is that states also, like the NSA, have really powerful states, can also amass huge servers.
Does this make you nervous about what you do online?
Oh, yeah, very, very. I don't know if what I'm doing is important enough to be, like, but checked out by these.
One day it could be. You've seen it. Trevor Noah goes on The Daily Show, and suddenly they dig up a tweet where he's making some feminist joke.
Yeah. Yeah.
10 years ago, and they make him seem like a misogynist.
Yeah.
They could do this to you.
Sure. I think it is like a cause for concern how much power these servers have accumulated. And, like, it just takes one evil person at the head of Google to, like, decide they're going to, you know, not do the right thing.
So how do we safeguard this? Because people in minorities, and we're all going to be minorities if these huge companies decide that they're going to flex their muscle. How do minorities protect themselves against a mob?
You know what? I don't know in this era. Like, my real fear is that the technology is just so sophisticated that it's almost impossible.
That's not a very nice view of the future. That's very dystopian. What's up with you? I thought you were going to inspire us.
I'm just here to try and tell the truth.
Oh, Jesus. So shall we just all run into the sea right now? Come on. If you're going to be one of the future leaders of this country, help me. Give me something to aspire to.
Well, look, I think democracy is we have to hope that the people who exercise public power are accountable to the public. We've seen in the United States, for example, with the NSA, how in some ways the democratic deficiencies have prevented us from understanding, but in other ways, you know, people using the democratic system to try and get the information into the hands of the public can influence the way that people exercise power. So that's also why it's so important in South Africa right now that, like, we preserve our democracy. I don't think people understand to what extent the assault on our democracy is happening. Like,
so that brings us to here. What do you forecast and what do you hope? They might be the same thing, will happen here in the next little while. Because this is, we're right in the middle. We're in the eye of the storm now.
We are. We've got a war on our hands. The interests that are at the helm of this country are literally, I'm convinced of it, they have a coordinated assault on our democracy. They want to turn us into a state that is...
Who are they? Because otherwise you
Zuma,
do... Again, you sound like a conspiracy theorist unless you name them.
The president and the financial interests that back him, the Zuma cabal, all of the financial... And by the way, this notion that somehow the ANC under Zuma is anti-imperialist. I mean, the first thing Zuma did as soon as he was elected president of the ANC in Polokwane was go to the United States. Anyway, so...
Do you think the ANC can heal itself? You said earlier you think it's finished.
I think it's finished. The big savior is supposedly Cyril Ramaphosa. If you read chapter 10 of this book, you'll understand why Cyril Ramaphosa is not the person to save South Africa. There is nothing left. And it's really sad. Listen, like, I have pictures of myself at 2 years old with an afro wearing an ANC t-shirt. Mm-hmm. Like,
you were dyed in the wool, man.
This thing is personal, you know, but... We have got to the point where the only way we're going to bring ourselves back from the precipice is if the ANC is challenged for power. And unless that happens, then I really fear for our future.
Isn't it wild, though, that you have sort of a center, in our politics, center right and left with the EFF, DA.
Yeah.
You almost find them cooperating more than even people within the ANC are cooperating with each other. Do you think that that's healthy, or do you think that that's just a short-term solution?
I must say, I'm actually quite encouraged by the way it's worked. At the end of 2016, people were saying these coalition governments would fracture and it would take a matter of weeks until they all collapsed. It's actually been relatively stable. And I think that there is a way where South Africa benefits from having an opposition government in power in 2019. It's going to be messy. But my question to people is, how much messier can it get? Do you think there'll be one family that comes in and ransacks all the state institutions? Inequality gets worse. Unemployment shoots to higher levels than in 1994. And we're in a recession. Like, how messy do you think that coalition is going to be? They will have an incentive to deliver because they'll only have a certain majority. And I don't think we have the luxury of worrying about stability right now. We're in an unstable crisis.
Do you think some people will go to jail?
I really hope so. Like, I think
we all do.
This is the big myth, right? Is that as soon as Zuma leaves the presidency, the ANC can move on. No ways. He is going to haunt the ANC and the country for as long as it takes. Because look, let's say Zuma leaves tomorrow, right?
Mm-hmm.
His corruption case is coming up in September.
Mm-hmm.
His successor is going to have to decide whether to reinstitute the prosecution. If they do that and he's found guilty, well, then the last decade has just been a big farce because we've actually had a corrupt president who used the money he gets to keep himself out of jail. If his successor gives him some amnesty deal, then what does that say about the rule of law? We've seen this with Mduduzi Manana and Grace Mugabe. Now this thing is like, if you're powerful enough, then the rule of law doesn't matter. Yeah. That's the whole point of the rule of law is specifically for powerful people. If they do something wrong, it has to work. It can't just work for people who are powerless and the powerful have a different law that's applied to them. So there's going to be a huge crisis if you get some amnesty deal. And that's going to dog the ANC for as long as it takes.
I want to talk to you again, so we've run out of time now, but we're going to do this soon. We get into some detail.
Sounds good. Oh, sorry, I couldn't drop the verse.
Do it now. I wish I had some kind of beat for you.
Mr. President, it's been a while since we last spoke. To think I once thought you were our last hope. Now your yesterdays outnumber your tomorrows. What do you think about when you're all alone? Mr. President, the walls are closing in. You could have been a nobleman. Now the applause is growing thin. Mr. President, can you see us crying for help? Do you see the light or are you blinding yourself? Mr. President, you desecrated the ANC. How could you abandon your bravery? How come you smile in our faces when you lie so blatantly? How can you trample on the graves of those who fought courageously? How many times we gotta say we can't afford the fees, Mr. President? They still discriminate racially. How much longer can the people be told to wait patiently? We need to be free from the slavery.
Well, hey now.
And that you can get with the companion album to the book.
Democracy and Delusion. Hey,
that's right.
Wow. Coming soon.
Democracy and Delusion, Sizwe Mpofu Walsh. What a pleasure to see you, dude. By the way, where's the Walsh from?
Such a pleasure. That's my mom's maiden name.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Explaining this stuff to me. All right. Thank you, Sizwe. It's always nice to talk to you. And we will get you in here again soon. Talk a little bit more about the detail of what's in the book.
For sure. I've brought a signed copy for you.
Yeah. Thank you. Because I had notes on it, but I hadn't read the book yet. And I'm going to have some weekend reading. All right, everybody. Here's Alan Ford with a look at what's going to be going on his show a little bit later on. Al, how are you this morning? Let me just get your microphone on. Alan's got the Unview coming up next. Al, you there? Hello?
Hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, magic. Great weather here in Johannesburg. And of course,
thank you. Reporting live from Johannesburg.
Filled with wonderful entertainment, Gareth. Let me just tell you, we've got Olympian Rake Nietland joining us,
yes,
talking about he's the new CEO of the Princess Charlene of Monaco's Foundation.
Okay.
We're also planning to get her on your show quite soon.
Awesome.
We've got from Freshly Ground, Zolani Mahola, who's doing Calling Me Home, the opening of a new musical,
nice,
happening tonight at the Civic. Malcolm Kluck and Christian Gabriel de Toy joins me in studio because they just had the opening of the AFI Fashion Week. And they are just great. I mean, and the fashion shows were beautiful.
Are you going to some fashion shows, Al?
Oh, I do love a bit of fashion. You know, it's so hot. And then Dalen Oliver, comedian. His new movie begins, opens this Friday. And, of course, yeah, he's got a new comedy show in Cape Town. We also talked to Dare to Share's Mark Berra about his charity evening. And we just talked to a great restaurant in Durban. It's a full-packed entertainment show with myself and the one and only Nathan Rowe. It's the Unview, the Thin, the Rich, and the Fabulous.
Thank you, Al. Very good. There's Alan Ford, everybody. Lots coming up on that show.
Oh, this place.
All right. Yeah, it's going to be a busy day. There's lots of other good stuff too. Don't go away. Here is the Unnews, everything you need to know. Thank you to Sizwe. Thank you to Sia. Thank you, Mubs. Thank you, Amanda. Thank you, Ben. All right. You want to know what's happening in the world? You come to the right place. Here's a quick summary of today's news. Finance enthusiast Malusi Gigaba is very unhappy about FNB's CEO wanting to fly in any airline except SAA again. Gigaba's office said that all South Africans should support the embattled airline, especially those that fly business classes. They generate the most profit. Marley van Breda will not testify against her brother Henry van Breda in court. She says the memory of the fateful night is still not there, and she wants her Ace of Base CD back that Henry took from her in 2009. That she is not prepared to forget about. That CD is very important to her. Finally, Real Madrid beat Barcelona again last night with their Spanish Super Cup win, setting the tone for the season ahead. Many are suggesting that the loss of Neymar is already impacting the team, but others are suggesting the players are off form right now as they grapple with defining their sexuality after seeing Ronaldo with his shirt off on the field last week. That's all for you. That's all for me. We will see you tomorrow, Friday.
This is CliffCentral.com.